Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Division One of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases scheduled for oral argument this afternoon. The first case is People v. Shockley. Are counsel seated and ready for that case? Okay, the second case that we have is Simmons v. General Steel. Are counsel here and ready for that case?
Ready for the appellate, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear argument second in that case. I think you're familiar with our procedures, but I'll review them briefly. As you know, we have 15 minutes for each side. We have a color-coded system that starts green and turns amber when there are 5 minutes left, and red when your time is up. We also have a digital timer so that you can determine for yourself when you'd like to reserve time for rebuttal. However, if you'd like me to remind you at a particular point, if you're representing the appellant, just let me know, and I will try and do that. You should know that the judges have had a chance to read the briefs, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record, so you may wish to focus your arguments on the legal issues rather than the facts, but how you present the argument, of course, is up to you. You should be aware that there's a toggle switch on the podium that you can raise or lower to suit your convenience. You should also know that we post the oral arguments on the internet, so if you have any private or confidential information, you may wish to be careful as to how you phrase that. And finally, I would ask that anybody who has a cell phone to make sure that it's turned off so it doesn't interrupt us inadvertently during the oral arguments. So with all that having been said, we're ready for the oral argument in People v. Shockley.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Sarah Kellogg, registration number 39236, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Shockley, in this case. The central issue in this case is the credibility of P.S., the alleged victim. There was no other evidence of the alleged assault beyond P.S.'s allegations. The problems raised in the first three issues of the brief address P.S.'s credibility, and they include both evidence that was improperly submitted to the jury, as well as evidence that was erroneously excluded from the jury's consideration. Specifically, defense counsel was not allowed to present testimony from a teacher who was going to give her opinion that P.S. had a character for untruthfulness. Defense counsel was also severely restricted in its cross-examination of P.S. and P.S.'s mother regarding the school records that showed P.S. had a tendency to fabricate stories in order to get attention. In contrast, the prosecution was allowed to improperly bolster P.S.'s credibility by asking prohibited questions of the mother, the friend D.S., as well as the detective, if P.S. was telling the truth on the specific occasion that he alleged the sexual assault. I plan to start with issue three today, which addresses those improper questions, but would like to address issue one as well, time permitting, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may as well. As I said, the third issue addresses those improper questions. The prosecutor first asked the mother if she could tell when P.S. was lying. Had he lied to her before? Did she think he was lying to her that day in the car? And then finally, was there any reason to believe he was not telling her the truth that day? These questions are not allowed as a matter of law, and it was error for the prosecutor to ask them. The questions to the mother alone amount to reversible error in this case. However, the prosecutor continued and also asked the friend, D.S., who equivocated in his answers, and then asked the detective as well, who affirmed that D.S. had said he believed P.S. when P.S. Made this on the specific occasion that P.S. made the allegation. These questions, as a matter of law, were error. That is well-settled law from People versus Eppins, and it's also a rule of evidence under 608A. Defense counsel did not object to the questions put to the mother or to the friend D.S., and so review for those questions would be under a plain error standard. However, defense counsel did object to the questions put to the detective, and so review under that for those questions would be under a harmless error standard. The case People versus Cook is instructive in applying a plain error standard of review in this case. And like Cook, reversal is required here. Cook notes that plain error is error that is obvious and substantial, meaning that it undermined the fundamental fairness of the trial so as to cast serious doubt on the reliability of the judgment. The error in this case was obvious, as was the error in People v. Cook. Cook noted that it was well-settled law, and as I mentioned above, it's clear that it was. So the error here was obvious. The error here is also substantial, and so reversal is required. As in Cook, this case comes down to the credibility of P.S. There was no other and independent corroborating evidence. There was no physical evidence. There was no third-party eyewitnesses, despite the fact that there were three other boys in the room at the time the alleged assault occurred.
There was, excuse me, Ms. Kellogg.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question, please.
Certainly.
Just mentioned that this is plain error because the error is substantial, and we know the effect of it is substantial.
Right.
In Cook, the question asked of the witness was asked by a juror, so I think it was obvious from the Cook circumstances that it was of serious concern to the juror.
Right.
Or possibly to the jury. How do we know that this was an area of serious concern for the jurors in this case?
Well, I think because the prosecutor reiterated numerous times in closing argument that this case came down to the credibility of the victim. And as in People v. Cook, the prosecutor here also said that, you know, if the jury believes the victim, then define the defendant guilty. And if the jury doesn't believe the victim, the defendant is not guilty. And that's what the prosecutor said in closing in Cook, and the prosecutor said the same thing here. And I think even though there was no juror question, it's true. This entire case was based upon whether or not P.S.'s allegations were true and whether or not he was telling the truth.
Ms. Kellogg, can I follow up with two questions?
Certainly.
It's clear from the record that after the victim told mother what had happened, she took him to the police station.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah.
Meaning, I think the implication is she believed what he said, let's take this to the police. If she had disregarded him, she wouldn't have done that.
Presumably, right.
Second follow-up is, the jury acquitted the defendant of one of the charges that the victim's mom said was he was telling the truth.
Right.
So how does that affect a plain error analysis?
I don't think that it actually does affect the plain error analysis. For the charge of which he was acquitted, the assault from the ashtray being thrown at him, right. The P.S.'s testimony was that there were other boys awake and in the room and would have seen this happen, and no one else could testify to that. And so I think the evidence there was even stronger that P.S. was not truthful, whereas the evidence of the allegations for the sexual assault, there was no corroborating or contrasting evidence. It was solely P.S.'s word that these assaults happened. And so I think because there was evidence that the other boys did not see the ashtray, that is different than the analysis for the allegations of sexual assault that they come down
but
to.
Mom still said he was telling the truth about the ashtray. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And I think, I mean, I guess the questions themselves were error. And so I think this court's questions are, so those questions should not have been asked, and that testimony should not have been put before the jury. And in the harmless error, I'm sorry, in the plain error review for this court, that could be potentially one consideration, but the court looks at whether or not there was any other and independent corroborating evidence, as Cook stated, and the other cases as well.
Well, in this type of an assault, I'm not sure, seldom, I guess I would say, is there corroborating evidence.
I think that's true. In this case, however, there was the opportunity or the potential for three other eyewitnesses to have observed something over the P.S. testified it occurred over an hour and a half span of time.
Asleep, presumably.
They were presumably asleep. But there was the testimony was that Mr. Shockley got up and walked away and then came back. And there was certainly the opportunity, if this alleged assault occurred, for those boys to wake up and to observe something or have some. So it's not the true, the majority of cases where there's just, it happens where there's no one else, when there's no one else around, and there's no other opportunity, certainly.
Ms. Kellogg, in assessing whether there was plain error, is it appropriate for us to consider the other issues that you've raised in your brief?
I think absolutely, and I think that in particular, and maybe this helps to answer your questions as well, Judge Furman, but in particular, the issues one and issue two go to the fact that P.S.'s character for untruthfulness, and apparently there was some and substantial evidence that he had a character for untruthfulness, was not presented to the jury, and they were not able to consider that. And that is for the province of the jury to determine the credibility of the victim and of witnesses. And here, the court's erroneous rulings on both the teacher's testimony and the cross-examination of the school records prevented the jury from really evaluating the credibility of the victim. And I think that absolutely goes to the plain error analysis here. In fact, in the other cases that address these issues, like People versus Eppins, they note that there was other evidence that corroborated, in, such as physical evidence, and, you know, looked at the other, the case as a whole and looked at the other evidence that was submitted to determine whether or not it was reversible error, as did, you know, People versus Cook. That case looked at the evidence that was presented and how the jury was able to determine the credibility of the victim. And so I think that that absolutely applies in this case as well. As I stated also for the plain error analysis, the prosecutor emphasized numerous times in closing that the case was about P.S.'s credibility. And then finally, in contrast to People versus Eppins, the case I just noted, here in Eppins, the social worker testified on direct that she believed the victim was sincere in that case, but on cross-examination admitted that her opinion could be disputed. Whereas here, the mother actually noted in cross-examination that she had absolutely no doubt whatsoever that P.S. was telling her the truth, and I think that aids this court in its plain error analysis. Again, it's a harmless error review also for the detective's testimony, but you know, taking these numerous questions to three separate witnesses certainly requires reversal in this case, but I think any individual witness would also amount to a reversible error, the questions posed. You know, Cook notes that these cases where the sole issue is the credibility of the victim, these questions are not proper and you know, do require reversal. If the court has no further questions on that, I'd like to briefly address issue one, the court's erroneous exclusion of the teacher's testimony. She was going to testify that she knew, presumably, that she knew P.S. throughout eighth grade. She was his teacher in two classes, and that he had an opinion, she had an opinion that he had a character for untruthfulness. And that is admissible testimony under 608A, Colorado Rule of Evidence, as well as just the constitutional right to compulsory process, right to present a defense, due process, fair trial rights. The error here was of constitutional magnitude, partly because of the limitation of the cross-examination in the school records, which is raised in issue two, and then also because of issue three, the bolstering of P.S.'s credibility.
Ms. Kellogg, isn't it appropriate for the trial court to inquire the basis for a witness's belief that someone else is untruthful in order to determine whether it's based on a well-founded set of circumstances or just based on a single incident?
I think that goes more to weight of the testimony, that those specific instances should be inquired into on cross-examination. I think the court should inquire initially into just the knowledge that the witness has of the person for about whom they're testifying.
So if as in this case, the teacher says, well, I've known P.S. for several months, and during that time I've determined his reputation for truthfulness, then that in and of itself is sufficient for the trial court to conclude that she could testify as to his truthfulness?
Yes, absolutely. And opinion or reputation. So she could testify either if she knew of his reputation for untruthfulness or her own opinion, having known him throughout several months in the classroom. And then to the extent that the prosecutor wanted to challenge that, they could certainly ask on cross-examination, well, give us specific instances when he was untruthful, to attempt to show that it wasn't well-founded. But if knowing someone for several months as a teacher is certainly sufficient to qualify them to testify if they have an opinion one way or the other of the person's character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. So I think that that was error. And because of the other issues, it was constitutional error in this case, and the state has not shown that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and so reversal would be required for that issue as well.
But in this case, I think defense counsel's offer of proof with regard to issue one and the exclusion of, or the request to admit the testimony of P.S.'s teacher,
mm-hmm.
was that he was going to ask her questions about specific incidents of throwing spitballs and about a refrigerator being full of juices or food.
I think...
And not her opinion of his general reputation for truthfulness.
I think actually the prosecutor characterized it that way, but defense counsel initially stated flat out that he was going to present her opinion for his PS's character for untruthfulness initially. And then the prosecutor started arguing about that it was only based on these two instances of the spitballs in the refrigerator, as you state. And unfortunately, defense counsel didn't, you know, say as much as one would like to rebut that. But I think that was the prosecutor's classification of what this testimony was going to be. But initially, and I can find the site for the court if you want, defense counsel did state pretty clearly that that he was just going to call the witness to testify about her opinion.
Ms. Kellogg, I know you said you wanted to reserve 2 minutes. You're down to about a minute and 20 seconds.
Thank you. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. That's fine.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kathy Gillespie, and I'm here on this afternoon on behalf of the people. My registration number is 26109. I don't have much more to add to my arguments than what I already presented in the briefs, but I would like to point out a couple of things where I think that opposing counsel is in error. As to the first issue that she addressed, which was raised in the opening brief as a Liggett issue, the were they lying type questions, I think the court needs to look carefully. The detective's testimony is looked at for plain error as well. The objection down at the trial court level was hearsay. It was not based on the Liggett objection. So I don't think that was properly reserved for appeal. So I think all three of those statements would be looked at under a plain error analysis. And then I think that the classification that they give to both the friend of the DS, I think, was the child that was asked about whether or not he swore on it, and the detective, the mother was asked what signs she typically sees when her child is lying to her. And I think that's a close call as to whether or not that crossed the line. But I do think that in this case, it didn't rise to the level of plain error. The way it was raised in the opening brief is, and I think I explained that in my answer brief, was the Liggett questions. It was not a question of your child was just testifying here in trial, were they or were they not lying? It was a question of at the time of the disclosure, and if she believed him, how then she reacted from that point and what she did based on the outcry that he had made.
Well, Ms. Gillespie, let me ask you about that. As I'm sure you have noted, Ms. Kellogg assiduously avoided citation to the Liggett case in her opening argument and instead referred to 608A and the Eppens case. What is your response to the applicability of those cases with regard to the clarity of the law at the time of the trial here?
As far as the Eppens case, I don't think that this is the same type of situation where you have a social worker or somebody that's been qualified as an expert. Most of those cases following down from Eppens talks about social workers, forensic interviewers, detectives, police officers that are offering opinions on whether or not a child that they don't particularly know firsthand on a personal level are telling the truth.
You don't think mom is an expert on her son?
I think most mothers would like to believe that they're experts on their children, but I don't think that that's going to get as much weight from the jury. No, I don't. I think a jury is going to look at the mother and know that they have some credibility issues as far as being able to give a completely 100% honest answer about their own child. I think that has a lot less weight than a social worker or a forensic interviewer coming in, an expert on children, giving kind of more of an objective opinion as to whether or not a child's telling the truth based on scientific evidence.
Isn't there just the risk of just the opposite happening, that the jurors might give more weight to the mother's testimony because she's known the child all her life?
I think with the other issues, I don't agree with that. I think it would still, I think it's, you know, having a husband or wife testify about their spouse, a parent, child. I think any juror, reasonable juror, is going to look at that person and hold their opinion about somebody's truthfulness a little more carefully than they would an independent observer. And...
Well, what about the, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
What about the question I asked opposing counsel about the acquittal? I mean, mom believed that her son was telling the truth on the assault charge, and yet the jury acquitted.
And I think that goes back to whether or not, if, even if the court were to say it was error for those questions, whether or not it would rise to the level of plain error in this case. And I think the fact that they acquitted him on some of the charges is a clear indication that they were weighing the evidence properly, and no one guiding or no one witness was over the top as far as who they believed. I think they were looking at the facts of the case. I think in this case, the 404B witness that was substantially similar to the victim in this case probably had some great weight towards that as far as this defendant's MO and how he sexually assaulted these children. So I think the fact that there's an acquittal is a huge indication that the jury was not overly persuaded by, and it was a passing statement from the mother. It was about the disclosure, how she felt when her child disclosed to him, to her initially, talking about the demeanor and the behavior of the child, whether he was looking at her, things of that nature. And then the statement that the defense complains about as far as coming from DS, whether or not he was swearing on it, the court goes back to the record. DS answered that question at trial that he partially believed the victim, but not completely.
Yeah, and then, I think he said, no, I didn't believe him.
I do too, and I think he tried to, I think he first said it was something about I partially believed him, and then he said no. So in that case, that almost goes against the prosecution, because you've just had a witness on the stand say that this kid made a disclosure to him, and DS didn't believe him. So I think you would be hard-pressed to
find. The detective countered that statement.
The detective countered that statement by saying that DS had given inconsistent statements. He didn't say whether or not PS was telling the truth. That's not even in the same ballpark as Liggett. The detective was asked whether or not, having listened to DS's testimony at trial, was there anything in the interview that he gave to you during the investigation that's inconsistent with what he said at trial? And the detective explained that there was. The detective did not go a step further and say, I believe this version and not this version. The bottom line is there's an inconsistency, and DS has told two different stories on that particular statement. So I don't think any of those would rise to the level of plain error. The other issue, and the court touched on it, and I argued it in my brief as well, is to the character for untruthfulness. And I wholeheartedly disagree with defense counsel. I think the trial court has an absolute obligation before a character witness takes the stand to have some sort of foundational requirement for that opinion. And in this case, the defense was given the opportunity when the prosecution objected on relevance grounds. The courtroom was cleared, and the defense counsel was given an opportunity to lay an appropriate offer of proof. And he was unable to do that. And if the court goes back to the offer of proof, it was not the prosecution's characterization of that offer of proof. The teacher talked about the fact that the child, P.S., had talked about not having any food in the refrigerator, and that's why he had to sneak out. And then she talked about the spitball incident. So there was no basis, and I think under an abuse of discretion standard, which is what this was under the character for truthfulness, I think the trial court has an absolute obligation, especially in a he said, she said type, or he said type situation, to make sure that there's a basis for any reputation or opinion evidence that's coming in. And they
is that more of a 403 question?
I think it can be. I mean, that was my argument in my brief, was I don't think they laid an appropriate offer of proof. And I think that the court made the right call, which was the probative value of an opinion that a child is untruthful because they lied about a spitball in the eighth grade. I think it goes down to the prejudice versus probative value, and that's for the trial court to decide. The record supports that decision, and I think that should stand. Unless the court has any other questions, I think the child hearsay argument, Newborough, the 1991 amendment, which obliterated that argument, and the 404B has been laid out. I would also point out for the court that the defense talks about the fact that the child's character for untruthfulness, something that comes into play in all of these situations, is the fact that most of this evidence did get in front of the jury. Their expert, Dr. Finney, talked about for pages and pages of transcripts about P.S.'s history, his history for exaggerating things in the school records to get attention, his difficulty or alleged difficulty in telling the difference between truth and fiction and dream and reality. This went on for pages in the transcript, trial transcript. So even if the court were to find that cross-examination should have been given a greater latitude, I think it still is doesn't rise to the level of reversible error, because all of that information got in front of the jury. They considered it and convicted him of both counts of the sex assault. So if the court, yes, sir.
I do have a question. I'd like to ask you about something that Ms. Kellogg didn't mention, but she did address it in her brief, which is part of the prosecutor's closing argument about the disparity between the prosecutor and the defendant's attorney, and suggesting that defense attorneys do not have to abide by a code of ethics. Can you respond to that argument, please?
I can. Clearly it was out of line. However, I think that the closing argument from both attorneys in this case were clearly out of line. And the court, while the comments from the prosecutor should not have been made, even whether or not they are a technical correct statement of the law, that the prosecutor has to make sure that a fair trial is given to both sides, I think you have to look at it in light of the fact that it was rebuttal. And then I listed the numerous statements in the defense attorney's closing argument where he talked about the prosecutor wanting to win at all costs and ranting and raving. It's clear that these attorneys had no love lost between the two of them. But I think if the court looks at that statement in the context of the fact that it was rebuttal argument and that there were numerous inappropriate comments made during the defense's closing, I don't think the court can come up with any error as far as any effect that that had on the verdict. There were final instructions given telling the jury that this is argument, it's not evidence. And so while I agree that it is probably inappropriate, I think when the court looks at the defense attorney's closing argument and the opening shots that were fired, it was in context, I should say.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gillespie. You have, I believe, a minute and 22 seconds. Okay.
Is that okay?
That's fine with me.
It's fine with me.
Okay. What we have here is an opportunity to examine technology at work.
Addressing Liggett, I simply, and I apologize if this was not clear from the writing in my opening brief, but Liggett versus People is simply a recent Supreme Court case that illustrates the continuing validity of the fact that a witness cannot give opinion testimony that another witness was too truthful on a specific occasion. It stands for that proposition. It extends that rule and makes it even broader. But it does cite to Athens and it notes the continuing validity. These other cases are somewhat older, and this is just a more recent case. So that's the reason why I cited to Liggett. Additionally, Judge Furman, to go back to your question about the ashtray and the fact that he was acquitted on that charge, I think that that can actually cut both ways, because it shows that the jury did have some doubt as to his credibility. And if it hadn't been improperly bolstered, and if the proper evidence had been admitted in the cross-examination regarding the school records and the teacher's testimony, I think that that's what shows that this is plain error here, because that had this been an actual trial with appropriate evidence to fair trial, the jury might have had a very different view of the witnesses and the evidence in this case. And so I think that that acquittal on the one charge actually cuts both ways. And the 404B evidence, I just want to quickly state that Mr. Shockley was acquitted on that subsequent charge. I think my opposing counsel stated that he abused both boys, but he was acquitted on that charge.
Your revised time has expired.
It has. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kellogg. Thank you again, Ms. Gillespie. We appreciate both of your helpful arguments in this case.